thanks
por permanecer otra vez en nuestro congreso.
Staying with us in this congress. And I ask you to please take your seats and do not close the doors, please, because it is coming pretty warm in here. We have had a wonderful agenda today. And to close, we're going to do our best as well. We're going to have our last and fourth plenary session, Diplomacy in Global Health, moderated by Dr. Jaime Sepúlveda. He represents Gates Foundation. Many of you know him because he has the director of this institute, and we have good memories of him when working at this institute. Please be welcome, Dr. Sepúlveda, and he's going to introduce the panel members. Thanks, Doctor. Good afternoon, you all. We have... No se escucha ese micrófono. We have a great panel. We have experts in this very important topic of international health. I reiterate the initial concept of having a great panel addressing a topic that I believe is one of the interesting global health topics and growing in terms of its importance, and a very interesting topic for the development of the discipline in global health. With us, we have a distinguished group of people who are going to be talking about global health with authority. To my right, we have a career diplomat, Dr. Carlos Garcia de Alba. Today, he is the director of the Matias Romero Institute, Mexican Institute abroad. An institute located abroad. This is an institute that directly depends on the Foreign Affairs Ministry, and with an important development in the promotion by the Mexican government abroad. And Dr. Garcia de Alba is going to share his experiences in the area of diplomacy with us. He's going to also talk about his relationship with health. To my left, Mauricio Hernandez Avila. He is an Undersecretary of Health. He was also one of the directors of this institute, and he's an epidemiologist. Internationally recognized epidemiologist, Professor Tom Nobotny. To me, he is the one who opened my eyes time ago on the new field, health diplomacy. There is not an easy translation, health and diplomacy, two separate fields, while in English, health diplomacy is talking about a new field, which is not only the addition of two different fields. Tom Nobotny was in San Francisco, California University, and then he migrated to the California University, but now at the San Diego campus, and from there he has promoted the health diplomacy successfully. So we have panel members, pretty knowledgeable in their areas, and I'm sure in their presentations, they are going to be presenting very provoking topics, and I'll make sure we have a provoking debate in order to have a very interesting debate. And I would like to have the audience participation. I would like to make it an interactive forum. And without further ado, we're going to now start our panel. And I would like to ask Dr. Jeffrey Sturke to start with his presentation.
Muchas gracias, Dr. Sepúlveda.
Thanks, Dr. Sepúlveda, for this introduction. And I know he knows something about me, because I've always said that one of my dreams, it is not a message to my bosses, but I would like to be the director of the Mateus Romero. That is one of my dreams. So it is telepathy. I would like to be the director. But in the meantime, I have this fun and challenging responsibility of leading and heading the Institute of Mexican People in abroad, which is what is this very important institution all about. And I also thank the invitation of the INSP to participate in this panel, and I am very pleased to be with these brilliant panel members. It is a challenging topic, isn't it? Because diplomacy and health insight is required for this. And obviously we need to understand the government's institutions, and it's a matter of a good understanding between these two entities in order to properly address the migrant health. I will be talking about four different areas. First, I will be talking about figures and their frame of reference of migrant health. The second topic that I would like to address is the trend of the Mexican migration going abroad. The third topic, what is the health? What is the condition of Mexican migrant people, and I will be talking about the institute I represent and challenges and achievements. I will improvise some of my presentation and I will read some numbers. And it's very important to address numbers. We know it is a global and growing number and a growing trend. Today we have a little bit more than 200 million people all over the world who are migrants, 200 million people. And this is because they live in a country different from the country where they were born. And Europe is a continent with the biggest, highest number of migrants. One out of every five European people live in a country different from their countries of origin. And I would like to highlight this. In Mexico, we are not understanding it yet. And Mexico has the third biggest diaspora, only after India, with 36 million people abroad, China with 25 million people outside of this country, and Mexico with 12 million people, with only a minor difference. Let's remember the size of the China and India population. So the first diaspora in percentual terms in the world is going to be the Mexican. This is the size of our challenge. The migration phenomenon has a new dimension, and we need to closely work today with the different governments, with the governments of origin, the governments of transit, or the governments of the point of destination. The interdependence and the risk international transfer is one of the characteristics of mobile populations, and this translates into high vulnerability of our population, even for those who do not migrate. As we saw a year ago after the AH1N1 emergency. I would like to now talk about transnationalism and to be able to talk about diplomacy in terms of health. In relationship to migration, transnationalism refers to be connected to several places at the same time, or being here, not being here, or not being other somewhere else. This is the experience of being a migrant. There is an emotional as well as a rational aspect. Transport, the repercussion of migration on health are many, and they go all the way from the interruption of health care to psychosocial disorders that will increase the vulnerability not only of those who migrate, but also of complete families. Migration limits access to pensions and health insurance, and it will change diet habits and lifestyles. This is all change. Migration is a very complex phenomenon. A migrant is going to include in his or her suitcase aspirations, dreams, knowledge, as well as diseases and risks. Two, recent trends in our Mexican migration. In Mexico, there is a migration phenomenon that for the last two decades has radically changed because of its patterns. Now there is an important increase in the number of migrating children and women, and now there are many more regions which are the points of origin and the points of origin. Today, urban more than rural Mexican people migrate, and the migration phenomenon has lost its circular pattern, so there are different staying times in the United States. Today, for example, we have more residents in abroad than migrant people. The result of this phenomenon is there are many, many Mexican people living abroad. More or less 98% of the 12 million Mexican people living abroad live in the United States. This represents Mexican and Mexican-American people represent 29 million people in the United States. And here we can talk about 11.7 million Mexican people who weren't born here, the ones who crossed the borders, and the second, third, or even more generations of Mexican-American people. With a couple of examples, we can see how important these numbers are for these two countries. 27% of workers from abroad in the United States are from Mexico, a little bit more than one out of every four people. Secondly, according to the Homeland Department, in January 2009, the total population undocumented in the United States was 10.9 million people, undocumented people, and 6 out of every 10 of them are Mexican people, 6 out of every 10. A little bit more than 1 out of every 10 Mexican people lives in the United States today. 70% of Mexican migrants live in only 4 states, in California, Texas, Illinois, and Arizona, and they represent 1/5 of the total population. A recent phenomenon has been the growing dispersion of the Mexican diaspora going to now new destinations such as Georgia, Nevada, North Carolina, New York, Colorado, Florida, and Washington, among others. We now have consulates in Boise, Idaho, in Anchorage, in Little Rock, Arkansas, and these are only a few of the examples. Now, talking about Mexico, according to the numbers of the National Council of Population, 96% of our municipalities have permanent contact with the United States through migration. We have seen new states which are points of origin of migration. 2 out of every 5 new migrants in the year 2008 came from only 6 states: Chiapas, Guanajuato, Oaxaca, Sonora, Michoacán, and Veracruz. Today, there are new states which are points of origin of migration that go beyond Zacatecas and Jalisco, for example. Today, 16 out of every 100 migrants come from Chiapas. Chiapas is today the first migrating people state. Some of the characteristics of this migrating population: the average age out of 106 million Mexican people is 24 years. The average age of those who are there is 27 years old, 3 years older, and 78.4% of migrants go from 18 to 54 years of age. So it is a productive age population. Basically, we're talking about healthy population, but because of this new pattern I made reference to and the acquisition of new habits and the interruption of health care, they end by losing their health, but now they lose their health in a massive way. 61% of migrants do not have junior high school. They do not complete junior high school. They cannot favorably join the labor market. And only 16% of males, and this is very interesting information, only 16% of males, for example, no, I'm sorry, he's apologizing. He is correcting himself. Only 16% of female workers will have some type of health coverage, and 31% of male workers. So there is a huge difference if you see the coverage for male and for female workers. Three. What is the situation? What is the status of our migrants? Health status, it generates vulnerability. Migration represents physical and emotional disorders. And I will give you some examples. Erosion of the circular migration translates into the interruption of medical care. Language barriers and system changes, health system changes. All this will hinder access to health care, lack of financial education and protection. All this will have very low index of insurance, isolation, stress, and very low self-esteem. New mental pathologies, very important, and domestic family violence and abuse of substance and alcohol, alcohol abuse. Tomás Rivera Policy Institute. This is an organization specialized in addressing Latin American problems like health access, for example, published inequalities in the health of the minorities. It is a recurrent problem. Findings and recommendations for better multicultural health care. And I believe it is important to talk about this. In the United States, patients that belong to an ethnic or linguistic minority will face more inequalities when talking about health care compared to the rest of the population. We need to have much more medical and paramedic, Latin American origin people, Afro-American people, and other minority experts in order to render adequate services. Hispanic nurses, female and male nurses. There is a deficit that goes from 300,000 to 500,000. Latin American physicians represent 5% of the total population of physicians in the United States, and the percentage of the Latin origin population represents 14.6%. The universality in access to health services. The service should be rendered in the corresponding language, low cost and preventive care, specialized care, and emergency services. It is necessary to develop a prevention system in order to reduce dependence on emergency services at the hospitals. It is necessary to promote places that would promote healthy conducts and behaviors. And this is one of the first findings of this institute, Tomás Rivera. One of the main symptoms of the vulnerability of migrants is unequal access to health services, and specifically lack of frequent regular care. Four, what is the Institute for Mexicans Abroad? Which are the achievements and which are the challenges in terms of migrant health? The Ministry of Foreign Affairs, as Dr. Sepúlveda said, has a linkage program and an unparalleled program, and it is because of the magnitude of the population it serves and because of the many different actions implemented 20 years ago on April the 16th. In a week from now, we're going to celebrate 20 years of the community of the program for Mexican communities abroad. This is the father, this is the parent of the Institute for Mexicans Abroad. We are celebrating 7 years. It was created in the year 2003, and it works with the two embassies in the United States, in Canada, and with Mexico. And it works with 56 consulates. It is the largest network of consulates that a country has abroad. The Chancellor's Office coordinates this approaching effort with the different communities abroad, and the IME, the Institute for Mexicans, is the communications channel that allows to communicate information on programs and services rendered by the three different government levels and by the private initiative and non-government organizations. If we go, if we now talk about transnationalism again, we are going to understand that one of the main problems for the Mexican population migrating to North America was and is to be able to be given information, health-related information, and guidance. And this is why an international close cooperation among the different governments is very important in order to address the health needs of the migrating population. This is the reason behind diplomacy in the United States, because of the decentralized characteristic of the decision-making process in that country. The Institute for Mexican People has to coordinate not only with the federal government, but also with the state governments, with the counties, with cities, with local organizations, with sports organizations, with chambers of trade, with non-government organizations, with native clubs, and even with churches. 10 years ago, with a great support by the Ministry of Health, and this is a clear recognition, we started a promotion strategy looking for direct contact with the population. The idea was to replicate a strategy that was pretty successful in Mexico, the National Weeks of Health, and the first bi-national week of health was held in the state of California. This strategy comes from a productive collaboration with the University of California and with the California Endowment Foundation for the Mexico-California Health Initiative. The main goal of this bi-national health week is to bring together the migrant community and the community medical services through social mobilization to bring health services to those difficult to access places in the territory. It is important to say that the main component of this weeks are intensive vaccination campaigns in the United States. The different organizations and the different states that participate, they have defined their priorities according to the local needs. This is why there is a wide range of vaccination actions, women's health, vocal health, elderly people health, TB, diabetes, HIV, AIDS, etc. Year after year, bi-national health weeks are becoming longer and longer, and we now have the participation of the consulates of Mexico and the Institute for Mexicans to more states in the United States, and we could even talk about a real and actual Pan-American Health Week, because we're talking about 11 participating governments in this activity: Belize, Bolivia, Canada, Colombia, Ecuador, El Salvador, the United States, Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, and Peru. These weeks are so successful that they are now permanent ones. And in the year 2002, the first health window was created in San Diego as well as in LA. Its growth has been an exponential one in recent years. Today, it seems amazing, but we have 42 health windows out of a total of 50 consulates that we have in the United States. And I would like to highlight the following. This wouldn't be possible without the decisive support by the Ministry of Health and by Dr. José Ángel Córdoba. This program is guiding Mexican people who are in the U.S. territory on health services available in their communities. The objectives are the following, ones: to enroll people in different programs and to give them information on health prevention. As of the year 2003, more than 3.1 million people have benefited from these health windows, more than 8 times Cuernavaca's population. No other government program has grown as this health windows program, and not only the windows that we have in the different consulates, but we also have mobile health windows, and in this way we can bring services outside of the consulates. Today we have 4 mobile windows in Albuquerque, Fresno, Chicago, and even in the capital city of the United States, in Washington, D.C. This is amazing. Today, lots of people go to the consulates. Not only do I have a permission, but they go to our consulates to have their sugar levels checked, mastographies, prostatic antigen tests. If there is a dysfunction, it is now becoming an opportunity. It is a big opportunity, and we do these examinations, but now not only to Mexican people, Hispanic people, even U.S. people, they go to these consulates to have health services. France and Brazil, these two countries, are studying the project of health windows. And if these two health systems, the U.S. and the Mexican systems, are going to be addressing the same patients, we could have communications bridges, and we are going to get to know each other much better. So we are going to be making progress in our health diplomacy, something that is taking place and at every level in the different states in the United States. And in the case of these programs in favor of health, the success, persistence, and existence will depend on the trust and on the confidence that we can instill to our Mexican migrants. And the best way to achieve this is with visible and tangible results, as we've done so far. The main challenge is to approach even more to the migrating community so that we can improve their access to health services and to work gradually, to work continuously, efficiently, and with very sensitive and human contact with them. Last but not least, I would like to highlight that Mexico's experience when addressing the needs of this diaspora is a fundamental tool for this policy of international cooperation, which is characterized by non-government players, and we need to also have a sense of ownership of all these programs. And as we manage to tell the communities how useful these programs are, and if there is a sense of ownership, we're going to have efficient health diplomacy. Thank you very much. Gracias, Embajador García de Alba.
At the beginning, I was not following the logic as to why transnationalism and migrants might constitute part of health diplomacy. But now I understand that for the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Mexico, the health of the Mexican migrants is indeed part of its diplomacy workload. Now, I would like to propose this question for the debate, not to be responded now, but I just want to plant that in your mind, and I would love to see some of our American colleagues here comment on this. Now that the healthcare reform has finally been signed in the U.S., which I think is one of the most wonderful news that we have heard in a long time. And we really need to applaud the courage and the perseverance of President Obama. What is going to happen to those populations that live in the U.S. that do not have a legal status, which is not a minor number? All together, we're talking of over 10 million people, many Mexicans, but other nationalities as well. So what is going to happen to those people? It's good news that we have national health weeks that now involve the state of California and hopefully will extend to other places, but that is clearly insufficient. And so that is a question for the discussion that I would like to have later on. Déjenme ahora darle la palabra al doctor Mauricio Hernández.
Bueno, muy buenas tardes.
Good afternoon, you all. When I was first invited to present this topic, there were two possibilities: to coordinate a table on the lessons learned about flu, and another one was to participate in the health diplomacy session, global health diplomacy. And the truth is that I do not have that much of experience, so I will try to combine both. When I was first asked about health diplomacy, I thought this is what the area of expertise of Brazil. I found two of the speakers, and yes, they've done this for many, many years, and Cubans even more for a longer time. They've done this health diplomacy. So this is a topic in the global agenda that has been present for many, many years. So I looked for definitions in order to frame my discussion, and I found Alex Rux from the World Health Organization, and he says it is a new concept that includes bilateral, multilateral negotiations, activities relative to public health, consultations, dialogues, formal and informal ones that will lead to programs, actions, policies, and standards in every legal format, treaties, codes, rules, principles, etc., that can be valid across the planet. So it is not a new concept at all. But this gives us an idea of how broad this is, and I was very pleased because I know that I can talk about anything. Diplomacy in health, or health diplomacy, comprises different disciplines. Here we have a discussion: is it global health, is it international health, is it health diplomacy, or is everything going to be included in public health? Recently I saw a very interesting discussion in the Lancet on global health. There are negotiations, agreements on public health, borderless in the border states, intergovernment dependency, the recent reform that was just enacted. We were very pleased because of the U.S. citizens, but we're very sad because of the Mexican citizens that do not have a legal status as migrants, because they were totally excluded from this reform. Where shall I point? Which are the elements we have in Mexico in terms of diplomacy? Where do we do all this? Well, we participated in the meetings of the chairing committee of the World Health Organization. I also work in the consultative organization of the PAHOM. I participated with 8 other countries, the GSEC security group, where we have European countries and Japan and Mexico. It has been very important. We also participate in the APEX discussions, APEX, and we are also present in Central America, and in all these fora, Mexico is constantly talking and addressing health diplomacy. Now, let's talk about the pandemic. We carried out several actions. We addressed different health diplomacy. We were complying the international rule and code. We were also following the provisions of the World Health Organization. We had a prevention plan to prevent the pandemic. We were using the contention well-defined guides. We also had treatment clinical guides. We were pretty well prepared, I believe, and we belong to a security plan for the Americas, for North America. In this plan, with all the international commitments, we made drills to respond in the year 2006. This drill, we knew that in Mexico we were going to have this invasion via virus that was supposedly coming from the Asian Southeast. We didn't have in our plans. Virus from here. We had a reserve, we had a strategy, we had antivirals, more than 1 million antiviral dosages. We were pretty well prepared. We also invested. And we also invested in a vaccination plant. We had suspicions of how the international diplomacy was to be after this type of pandemic, how this was going to be a very important risk. Mexico had to be self-sufficient, specifically with this vaccination, because we knew that the international commitments we had were not to be fully complied with, and obviously because countries would prefer to give this assistance to their populations. So Mexico was getting ready for this. We knew this could happen. We wanted to have this plant. We were supposed to start operations in the year 2002. In terms of the response and in terms of the pandemic, in June 2009, the Ministry of Health decided to buy GSK vaccinations by Sanofi, and we bought this through Birmex. And we should also say that there was a collaboration agreement with Sanofi Pasteur and the Ministry of Health in order to have an advanced delivery of the vaccination in case of pandemic, which was the response by the industry in June 2009. The only one vaccination sold in Mexico was the one produced by Sanofi Pasteur. In August 2009, we finally had another supply proposal by another lab, and we also had the opportunity, and we were given a proposal by a Chinese company as well. The suppliers were not sure about their delivery dates. They were not able to tell us the expiration dates because, according to the industry, there was lots of uncertainties. There were many uncertainties. Is it related to diplomacy? Well, these are the different relationships we have with transnational companies where we have this context. And the final net effect was that Mexico was not given the vaccinations as timely. There was like an embargo of this vaccination. It was not an explicit embargo. There was a direction of production to the local market. I hear there were very important efforts by the Mexican diplomacy to duly meet those agreements and to start the vaccination of our population. So we knew that we agreed an early distribution, and it was completed in February 2010, and this is the only one Latin American country that started the vaccination campaign in November. We're going to finish our vaccination campaign in a month from now. We started with pregnant women, and we bought 215,000 dosages or vaccines. In this negotiation, we always talk to the different players, World Health Organization, PAHO, with the security group, APEC. Without a clear policy of all the different countries, we rather have one policy for each country, because the different countries we're taking care only of their own peoples. In terms of the impact in the different areas, there was a very good bilateral relationship. We managed to strengthen bilateral relationships a lot with the United States and with Canada, and Mexico used every collaboration mechanism for security with Canada and with the United States, and we were able to give record information in only 10 days. We also had regional collaboration during the epidemic with the World Health Organization. We used video conferences to alert other countries about the epidemic. We had a very important international agenda with the Security Committee that was kickoff. We had some unexpected and incorrect impacts, for example, the economic impact. Despite of the recommendations by the World Health Organization, despite of the recommendation of not restricting trips, air flights, and Mexico was punished by this flying alert, and tourism dropped significantly and without any evidence. For example, European countries and North American countries decided that Cancun was a site for this type of infection, and all the trips to the Mexican Pacific and to the Caribbean were canceled. And we know it was it was a place of risk, but not because of the Mexicans to others. It was a place for infections, but from U.S. people or from North American people coming here. This is why in the diplomacy strategy in Mexico, we thought that we needed to have a fund, an insurance fund, a type of an insurance, so that the countries that make reports in this type of period of confusion during the first stages of the epidemic, and if incorrect decisions are made, we wanted to have a way to recover. But we haven't made any progress. on this. So we can say that Mexico, the Mexican government, acted according to the International Health Code. We applied our plan, the plan that we built based on this health diplomacy, and we were in good communications, very active communications with the World Health Organization and with other countries in the region. The international press, it was pretty difficult at the beginning. The Mexican flu, Mexican people here, we were all in the main newspapers. Our planes were kidnapped in China. Tourists were maltreated. Reactions abroad are the ones we are all aware of. Argentina canceled trips. France assistants didn't want to carry suitcases, and soccer players didn't want to play with us, and Mexico suffered from all this. I have only 3 more minutes, and I will share my last slide with you. Talking about international relationships, Mexico is recovering. We know that Mexico was pretty transparent. Mexico submitted the reports, made the reports, and we have a better image today. Now let's talk about challenges, because this is the lesson that we learned. This is the most important lesson that I can share with you. I will now make reference to drugs, and I will be talking about vaccinations only, the vaccines only. First, we need to have global ethical criteria. What do I mean by this? All countries made a listing of our peoples that we had to vaccinate. We started with pregnant women, we started with children, we also started with people from suffering from illnesses, and we made a triage in order to assess lives in differently, to assess the life differently. The problem is that it is not enough in the border states. So with this nationalistic criterion, what if we want to vaccinate an 85-year-old man, and how can we compare it to a pregnant woman? So this one reason for some trouble in the border states. There were no transnational or international repercussions, but this is something we should also address. Secondly, countries didn't make an open price policy. This can sound pretty radical, because we were in an emergency, but the industry was to have an open and transparent price policy, a crystal price policy or case, and to know how they reach this price with only one antigen. It is produced as many other vaccines, but with 3 times the price. So we need to have this price case. And since we wanted to preserve our population, we didn't have a front line in order to face this situation. And you've seen now that European countries bought 3 times as much, and now they want to give the vaccines back to the companies. An early, timely donation policy. Those vaccines were never donated. It is like another failure. It was another failure of this diplomacy. The research by the industry, it didn't include all these mechanisms to know how to increase the availability of vaccines. Our vaccines were very well tested, but we didn't have methodological developments to be able to know if fraction in dosages would be another possibility and to have even more. There was a misinformation campaign, an amazing misinformation campaign. This is a vaccine that has been pretty attacked, and there was no advertising, there was no information to counteract this bad information about the vaccine. Now we need to better understand health diplomacy. We need to reinforce all these actions. And I will end my comment by confessing or by telling you that I still believe that if this is an H5N1 pandemic, we would fail. We would fail. We would flank at the world level with all this health diplomacy. We would fail. We would flunk because we didn't know how to properly implement all the mechanisms. This is information about Dr. Sepúlveda. So we have two examples. On the one hand, we have a great reform that doesn't approve this right to universal health, and it is leaving outside 20 million people outside of this reform and a natural experiment of a vaccination. We need to have a more efficient health diplomacy. Thank you very much.
Challenge the panelists to be provocative. I did not expect it would be that provocative, but that's precisely what we want to have here. Dr. Mauricio Hernandez is a straight shooter, and he tells things as he sees things from his direct experience. Ambassador Garcia de Alba brought the perspective of, as a diplomat from the Foreign Office, looking at diplomatic tools, instruments to protect citizens beyond the borders of Mexico. Dr. Hernandez is looking at the other side of the equation, how health has major diplomatic repercussions. And I think this is truly a fascinating debate. We see the health diplomacy binomium from two angles, from the diplomatic perspective, from the health perspective, and how they both interact. I think that is magnificent. A couple of thoughts for debate. South Africa elicited an international furor around its policy on HIV treatment in the previous administration. Indonesia provoked very much the same reaction when they were sequestering the vaccine seed from international development for a vaccine, and that also elicited a very strong international reaction. Mexico, I must say, from a completely objective, impartial view, if you can believe that, received a wide international applause and recognition for having shared the vaccine seeds from very early on. And I think those are contrasting experiences. But now Dr. Hernandez is presenting some of the consequences and some of the paradoxes. The fact that there's a surplus of vaccine now and countries don't know what to do with that surplus is indeed a sad irony when at the beginning many poor countries did not have access to that vaccine. Anyway, those are the realities of the world of health and diplomacy. Now it's the turn of Tom Novotny to speak about the new field as a legitimate new field in academia of health diplomacy, and he deserves a lot of credit for having developed and pushed for health diplomacy as a new legitimate field in academy. Tom? Yep. You can either use that one or this one.
Thank you. Is it on? Yes? All right, great. I want to say thank you to the organizers of the conference for inviting me, and I want to thank Jaime for his comments. It's always a pleasure to be on a panel with somebody so erudite and well-informed and insightful, and the previous speakers as well. Learned a tremendous amount about what an opportunity for health diplomacy lies, not just on our border, but around all of our states. And then I also want to congratulate Dr. Hernandez-Avila for his presentation, frank evaluation of some of the things that went on, and that, again, what happened was a great example of how health diplomacy is supposed to work in terms of the Mexican side. They did everything right and were transparent. It was a great contrast from what happened with SARS in China, and everybody from my government side, I know, realizes that. I was hopeful, or at least appreciative of the fact that President Obama had pledged 10% of our vaccine supplies for H1N1 when they were developed for sharing across borders. I don't think that was a gift. I think that was a necessity. I'm not sure how well it worked out and whether that donated vaccine was ever fully utilized, but that was at least an attempt at something on health diplomacy that is necessary, not just a gift. What I want to talk today about are several things, but since I'm a professor, I get to ask questions too, and I want to ask one or two questions and just to see where we stand. Even after the nice definition that has been provided for health diplomacy, how many of you out there think that you might be able to explain what health diplomacy is to your mother? Raise your hands, just as I thought. How many of you could define for me soft power? Anybody? You don't have to do it. You just have to say you can do it. A couple of people are trying to. Good. How many people know what the first health treaty was negotiated under the WHO? I'll give you a hint. It has to do with tobacco. Rings a bell to some of you. How many people, Americans, know what the Helms-Biden agreement is? Anybody heard of it? Ah, two. Great. This is better than most people. In terms of one or two other questions, how many of you know which UN agency governs the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria? And what agency would that be? I'm putting you on the spot. Yeah, very much so. There isn't one, by the way. That is an independent private-public partnership, which is an interesting concept in health diplomacy. Well, the fact that most of you couldn't answer these questions means that I'm not always have a job, so I appreciate that. Now, my background is as a primary care physician and public health physician, and I represented the United States for some time as the representative to the World Health Assembly's Executive Board and also to Pan American Health Executive, Directing Council. And those were very interesting diplomatic positions, and which is what stimulated me to continue to think about this and see how we can't define health diplomacy effectively and to use it better than we have. Well, by being both a health person and sort of a diplomat, I stepped in a lot of different puddles there, if you can know what I mean, none of which were always easily compatible. But I think it's important, to look at a couple of different things here. One is the definition of health diplomacy. Let's keep working on that one. Maybe we'll understand it at the end of the session. And then I'd like to evaluate some of the historical perspectives on health and diplomacy that continue to vex us and befuddle us at times. And then let's think a little bit about possible international as well as U.S. approaches to health diplomacy, because the U.S. is the big gorilla in the room when it comes to especially the multinational organizations. And what we do has lots of repercussions and has a responsibility as a result of that. That responsibility, in my opinion, during the last 8 years prior to this administration was sorely inadequate and did a lot of damage to the way people think about the United States. And what I believe health diplomacy should be doing as far as the U.S. side is trying to repair some of that damage. And then finally, what are we going to teach people about health diplomacy? Clearly, this isn't something you just plop down, read a book, or find yourself in a position of leadership without having some sense of what needs there are in terms of that. Now, defining health diplomacy is a couple of things. This is something I wrote in an article that we published in the World Health Organization Bulletin, political activity that meets the dual goals of improving health while strengthening international relations. Well, we hope that's what it does. There are several components of this. One is negotiations, and that's been alluded to already. And is that something you learn in public health school? Probably not. But that's what happens in the diplomatic world, which is why, in most cases, our diplomats do these treaties and things that require international agreements. But do diplomats learn about health? Maybe. They're getting better at it, that's for sure. Cooperative actions, this is the other part. You know, this kind of goes along with our changing concept between international health and global health, where international health is oftentimes a bilateral something that we do to somebody else, or it has a single issue that it is programmatic in this strictly vertical way. But really when it comes down to multidisciplinary issues and multinational activities, it requires a much more broad concept of cooperation to get anything to be done and to be sustainable. And then finally, development. Poverty, as Jeff Sachs has pointed out so eloquently in so many arenas, is really one of the determinants of health, and health is one of the determinants of poverty. And so those things become a development issue hand in hand. Now, here's some more definitions. Here's soft power. Now, there's just been a commission from the Center for Strategic and International Studies completing work on something called smart power, which is also important to understand. Soft power is to get what you want done through co-option and attraction. Diplomacy more or less is defined as getting somebody else to do what you want them to. But there are different ways of doing that. So there's soft power, and then there's hard power. And that's where you use the military or economic sanctions that are really, you know, inappropriate. Things that may fall under the WTO. Smart power is a full range of tools. And Hillary Clinton actually said that this was what she was going to do as she was being approved as the U.S. Secretary of State. So these include diplomatic, economic, military, political, legal, and I added the word medical, and cultural. So this is another way of thinking of what we're talking about with health diplomacy. Now, I've mentioned this global versus international health, so I'm not going to dwell on this, and actually I think it's on the GHEC website almost in this form, so let's just move forward. But globalization in health is an interesting concept that comes into the need for health diplomacy. First, we know what this is. It's the increase in technology and the movement of peoples across borders and capital and labor and all of these things that are happening with porous borders. The rationale for having a, for instance, a regional, at least, policy on vaccine development to protect against H1N1 makes such complete sense. It's silly to think that there would be an isolated response by one country without being able to share that response across countries that border each other. And the point that I wanted to make here is this last one, that national health interests, meaning a government nationally is responsible for the health of its people. Those national interests depend on the support or acquiescence of other nations. You can't take care of your own people unless you let go of your sovereignty and cooperate. And I think that's what we really don't realize when we talk about protecting our borders and health security. Come on. There you go. So the United States has really not had a good record lately. And you know, some of the things that we've been known for without, you know, this great science base that we have and all the really smart people trying to do good things in the world like you, we've come forward with things like waterboarding and complete disregard for the Kyoto Protocol on climate change. We don't believe that climate change happens. There's still a lot of people that are in that camp. And that we can get away with ignoring international conventions, such as the Geneva Convention on the Human Rights. And these things are rights of prisoners. But these things come back to bite you. And when we do need to cooperate, those things are some of the things that come up first and say, hey, look, United States, you want cooperation on all sorts of fronts. What about these issues? And I had to deal with some of these issues, and I represented the United States in multinational settings. So, but we have some other good things that we've done, or at least examples that could be used to expand our concepts of health diplomacy. After the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a lot of activities in terms of reducing the risk from weapons of mass destruction, biosecurity, and my office supervised well-funded and well-staffed interactions with the former Russian scientists who were there developing totally drug-resistant plague and anthrax and all these other things that we fear. And it managed to actually overcome that sort of animosity. But because of the failure of the Russian laboratory system, et cetera, that became not just their problem, but became the whole world's problem and needed this sort of health diplomacy in a very, very strong way to keep the rest of the world safe. Now, the history of health diplomacy, I'll move to that for briefly, comes out of missionary medicine. And that comes from the colonial enterprise. You know, colonists needed both workers to stay healthy and they needed to protect their own colonists from the tropical diseases that they weren't familiar with. So a lot of this was done for the sake of, you know, medicine and colonial and missionary medicine was done for the sake of protecting the assets, basically, of the colonials. And in fact, the London School of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, one of our great institutions, grew out of that colonial tradition. And it is something that I think we need to look back so that we don't repeat history in the future, but it was really something that started this whole idea of tropical medicine and international health. There's been legacies of this. One of those is positive. Scholarly research has taken on things like trade, mobility, diseases, etc., and then there have been a need to develop multinational agreements that related in part to health, but then again back to the need to protect commerce. There's nothing wrong with protecting commerce. It's just that even the international health regulations were really set out first to protect the movement of armies and of goods and services that were being traded across the world. They're now much more a health enterprise, the international health regulations. I won't ask how many know what those are. But they are an incredibly important set of international agreements that started way back in the 1850s, really. So we've had an intertwining of politics and health starting in the 1800s and now into the 20th century. Based on this need to support trade, fear of quarantine, etc., and after World War II, health became a critical political investment for the reconstruction of Europe, with the World Bank and the multinational organizations such as the WHO. And the growth of the bilateral agencies such as USAID, DFID, and others. And so its time has come and has been growing for some time. Now, the U.S., at least, has had a multifaceted role as a donor, a large provider of technical assistance, operating services directly, contributing to global health governance, conducting lots and lots of research, Roger Glass is here. We're glad to see his participation in this meeting from Fogarty International Center. And then a bit more in health diplomacy. And that's the part where I think we've got a lot more work to do. There's been just a huge flurry of activities from the federal side, and I think mostly in anticipation of a new leadership that says it wants to work more closely with other countries. President Obama has said this in many, many fora. And let's do what we can to support that. But there have been lots and lots of think tanks, the Center for Strategic International Studies I mentioned to, CICE, that is the Hopkins Foreign Relations Operation in Washington. There's now 40 to 50 new global health programs in academia. I don't know how many of them are looking at health diplomacy or foreign relations as a key component of these global health programs, but I think that time has come as well. The Kaiser report on the U.S. government's global health policy architecture is worth your read. You can get this off a website anywhere. And then at the same time, the Institute of Medicine's report on what the U.S. should be doing names, well, I've got a slide, saying that health and science engagement can secure U.S. goodwill abroad, and that health is a pillar of U.S. foreign policy. It's a pillar of many people's foreign policy, not just the U.S. It's a pillar of the Cuban foreign policy, and they've been doing it for years now in a very, very effective way by supplying health manpower around the world and providing free of charge training for in health at their School of Medicine and Nursing in Havana and other parts of Cuba. I don't know if you know this or not, but there's 52 Americans attending medical school in Cuba for free. They came from, by courtesy of Fidel Castro, they came from Harlem, South L.A., East Oakland, and they're committed to going back to those places. Maybe that'll help us with our redistribution problems in the U.S. At any rate, more and more involvement of this on other countries' parts as well. Well, anyway, this supports a lot of U.S. principles, health diplomacy, humanitarian concern. There's tremendous outpouring of a dollar here or $100 there or $1 million there. The Gates Foundation is providing billions of dollars, and it really is something that's part and parcel of our mentality. We need it, and I think it provides us both with that sort of sense of participation, but also it can help increase our security, it can help improve our image, and it'll certainly improve foreign policy coherence within our government and that with our partner governments across the world. Well, at any rate, science is important in health reduction, or rather in conflict reduction. We have 43 science and technologies agreements worldwide from the U.S. These are great things to do, not just for us, but the exchange of information and intelligence and knowledge and people really makes for a safer world. And in fact, just recently I read of some Stanford scientists going to North Korea and helping them set up a TB lab that they could do diagnostics with. What a great way to work with North Korea instead of putting economic sanctions on them might lead to starvation among some of the poorest people there. So anyway, there are lots of opportunities that as scientists and health providers that we can have. And then we have our friends in tell me how many I got. 3 minutes. Zero. our friends in the entertainment and donor industry as well. It shines a light to have Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt show up at Davos and tell the big guys what to do with their money. It helps to have big foundations putting money out there. It helps to have these foundations join with government and non-governmental organizations to increase both the public but private sector response. People want an outlet to work in this arena. And I think that there's increasing spending as a result of that, and the private sector response leads, actually, the government along to do the right thing. So I'm going to skip over a couple of these, but just mention one here, which was an Oslo declaration, a ministerial declaration. This ministerial declaration was not by the health ministers. The health ministers are the whips in most governments. It's the ministers of finance and the ministers of foreign affairs that have a lot of the power when it comes to what we're talking about here right now. Ministers of foreign affairs of several countries got together and said, health is our priority, and we are going to work together as partners to do that. The U.S. was not a part of that, but Brazil was, and Brazil is one of the best examples of participation in health diplomacy as well. Well, at any rate, I got to tell you this one because it's too ridiculous to not be true. There's a lot of kinds of diplomacies. And I found this headline of Viagra diplomacy, where our CIA, bless their little hearts, was using Viagra to involve Afghan informers to get information. So I don't know if that's soft or hard diplomacy, but it's diplomacy. Anyway, how do we evaluate the success? I'm not going to be able to go through this. We just don't have enough time. But I think that's one of the research questions that we must answer in schools of public health and global health to figure out what it is that works and to continue to develop that. So we have lots of examples. And again, I'm sorry I can't go over them right now. But there are training needs. And these training needs go across health, political science, history, negotiations, cultural humility, macroeconomics, everything you need to be a good negotiator. One more minute. I got to mention this one, because in the U.S., this is weird, and I know that this is happening in other places in the world, and most of you probably have not heard this, that our foreign development assistance abroad used to be about 3% through the military, and that's not military assistance or hardware or anything like that. It is now 20%, 22%. And the question I have, is this the right place for us to be doing health diplomacy? There's a lot of great people in the military, a lot of doctors, a lot of assistants. They've took the comfort ship to Haiti and spent a lot of time there doing terrific work. But my feeling is that should be led by civilians. Well, anyway, we're about to have the Obama Global Health Initiative begin. At $63 billion, which is a huge amount of money. Most of it is still PEPFAR. It is important, though, for us to understand this in our and study it in our global health courses, and I think it will be important for it to be supported over the next 6 years. So let me finish here by telling you that we have a training program and some ideas about postdoctoral training, and finish this off with advocacy that academia and the private sector and government and multinationals all need to work together on this health diplomacy idea for it to work. And here's a final quote from a former secretary of the Department of Health and Education and Welfare. There are no better grounds on which we can meet other nations and demonstrate our own concern for peace and the betterment of mankind than in a common battle against disease. Sorry I took so much time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. We're running out of time. Tom brings the perspective of both having been a public servant and also from an academic standpoint. So he did mention bilateralism. He did mention multilateral agencies. He did mention private foundations. And I think that is an angle that we need to recognize, that there are various ways in which health diplomacy is exerted. I fear that multilateralism is starting to decline as the most forceful way of doing business, and bilateralism seems to be taking increasingly a larger role as part of a diplomacy delivering health. Let us open this for debate. There are a number of provocative thoughts being presented by all three. I see one hand here, please.
Adam Hoverman, Yakima Valley Farm Workers Clinic, Eastern Washington, and faculty in the Pacific Northwest University of Health Sciences. Thank you, all of you, for tremendous presentations. I have to speak in from my clinical hat that Ambassador Garcia de Alba's presentation was very much in keeping with the stories I hear daily in Eastern Washington, which is very much part of the migrant stream. And in response to your question, Dr. Sepulveda, the answer appears to be what will happen to those 10 million, which I believe is a conservative number, will be that they will fall upon the community health centers. And working for the Yakima Valley Farmworkers, which is the third largest health center, community health center in the States, the large amount of money going to support the CHCs is hopefully a good response to that need for that number, which will be forgotten. In my academic hat, I am training the workforce and hopefully capacity building for those to fill those underserved provider seats, which we all know are rapidly emptying based on the declining interest in primary care. And so I would respond with a request to your esteemed foundation as to how they would support community health centers and training for those in that workforce.
Thank you. Vamos a tomar preguntas.
To have the questions first, and then we're going to give time to our panel members to respond. Would you please? Well, it was a very illustrative presentation, and I would like to share a concrete example of diplomacy. I come from Cuba, the Institute of Tropical Medicine from Cuba, Pedro. And I believe we, after the Haiti's earthquake, you know, and we all know the disaster, the number of people. I will not repeat this information, but this is an example of health diplomacy, because we Cubans were there, 1,500 Cuban physicians were there when the earthquake happened, and after the earthquake, the first assistance and the first collaboration was there. Cuba was there. So if you train students at the Latin American school, we made an invitation and we had the students from different countries who were already working in Chile, who were working in different places, even in Mexico, many different countries, and they were volunteers in Haiti, and they joined this collaboration. But It goes beyond this. It was a personal type of diplomacy. But we also had the government's formal diplomacy, because we wanted to rebuild the health system of Haiti. Despite of all the repercussions, and we had three governments, the Venezuela government, the Brazil government, and the Cuban government. And I can tell you that it was more or less 2 weeks ago when the two health ministers, the Cuban and the Brazil ministers, met with Preval in order to start the health plan. And this is starting to bring more people together. And I also would like to tell you that from all the students mentioned by the doctor, there were many North American students who are also working in Brazil. So I believe it is very, very possible. I just wanted to share this with you. Thanks, doctor.
No. Me llamo Andres Rusky.
And I represent the Health Systems Action Network. My question is, in the context of the spreading momentum of the use of internet to connect people, can you foresee the use of internet to connect public health stakeholders in Central and South America, in particular, utilizing social networks such as, not necessarily Facebook, but something like it, to build these bridges between public health entities?
Thank you. Un par de preguntas o comentarios
central
más
y del sur. A couple of more questions, and then we're going to respond, and then we're going to close.
My name is Jessica Everett. I'm a family physician. I'm also the medical director of Child Family Health International. I have two concerns about health diplomacy. One is that when it seems like the process, although it has many admirable goals, will actually lead to more politicization of health, and I worry about that because of the political swings in the United States and how our health policy is so fragile with those political swings. And I would hate to see our investment in other countries, as it is currently, become more vulnerable to those swings. So I wonder if you could, A, comment on that, and B, that it seems like health diplomacy runs a risk of breeding further dependency rather than independency for less rich nations. What Cuba's doing at Elam seems to be breeding independence down the road by training workforce versus what the U.S. tends to do, which is create further dependency that we use to leverage our agenda. Thank you.
Okay. ¿Hay alguna otra pregunta?
Are there more questions back there,
No sé si hay un micrófono.
Are there microphones?
Okay.
Voy a tratar de gritar.
Just because they are migrants.
Thank you. Okay, why don't we give an opportunity to respond? Tom, would you like to go first?
With the respect to the health diplomacy question over here on, you know, are we creating dependency and are we not paying attention to some of the other issues, I think that we really need a totally different structure of how we administer health aid. USAID has been disempowered and demoralized and deprofessionalized, for one thing. And you're absolutely right about the need to have sustainability and technology transfer rather than dependence, and not just dumping money on things. As I try to contrast, you know, the old concept of international versus global health is the international health is something we do to them or vice versa, and global health is something we do together. And so that the priorities and the ability to work together, just as several countries in that Oslo Declaration that I mentioned have dedicated themselves to do, can come up with better approaches and better systems. The U.S. has not been good at collaborative approaches, and it needs to be better at that. And the other issues is that we've got lots of money in this now. $63 billion is nothing to sneeze at. And out of that money needs to come more on health systems development, on human resource development, and some of that is in there. It could have been even more. And there are some really good ideas about how to do the development assistance that is depoliticized. One of the worst problems that I think we've had in the past is how politicized USAID and the appropriations that support it have become. And what needs to happen is that a higher level of health assistance administration needs to be established, meaning somebody right under the president. That probably would be in the National Security Council, so that you can get over a lot of the kind of disconnectedness and also encourage policy consistency that starts right at the top and works down through all of our systems. But, you know, that would then allow there to be a real science-based approach to this health assistance that would assure non-dependency. In fact, I'll just mention one last word and I'll shut up. The PEPFAR program is an entitlement program now. It's important to treat people, but you don't start treating them and then stop. And at this point, we have to figure out collectively as nations to continue to treat everybody that needs to be treated and not consider it just an entitlement program that we've invested in.
Yo haría un comentario sobre la pregunta de los networks, de las redes de Internet. Yo creo que la epidemia de influenza nos enseñó que ciertamente hay redes informales que son extraordinariamente poderosas.
Which are very powerful.
Claro que sí.
The response is yes, of course, yes. It is a space that we need to consider for more efficient communications, and at least in this epidemic, we lost and it damaged a lot. The vaccination policies, for example. In terms of the migrants, I believe migrants are very vulnerable because they are discriminated in their own countries because they left, because there is no social security without the economic support. Action and then migrants in the place where they are discriminated. The Obama reform is very good for Americans, but it gives place to segregation in terms of health. So it is an ethical problem. It is a problem. It is a dilemma because it is a fundamental right. Yes, health is a fundamental right, as the person up there said. So if there is a country with many, many resources and if they invest $60 billion in order to have an international strengthening interior, there is a segregation. It is not health diplomacy, and it is policy within the United States, and we need to think about it. La primera pregunta, y creo que la mayoría de las personas hicieron un comentario sobre esto. ¿Qué le va a suceder a los migrantes que no tienen papeles después de la autorización de la reforma de la salud en los Estados Unidos? Y es un desafío tremendo para todos. Bueno, pues en primer lugar, tenemos que recordar una y otra vez que todos los gobiernos son autónomos y soberanos, ¿verdad? Entonces tenemos que respetar al 100% estas decisiones nacionales que toman el gobierno de los Estados Unidos y el Senado y los representantes. Esto no significa que no sea un problema de derechos humanos, y con todo respeto, esa es la
those millions of people that have not this basic Medicare in the US before and after the approval of this health reform. But it's true. It's a matter of human rights too. But what will happen after this reform, after this approval? I think we have to divide this discussion in three different parts. For me, the first part, and possibly the most important, is that since we have millions of people, and just 7 million Mexicans with no papers in the U.S., so completely out of this reform, the first priority has to be more focus on prevention, second, prevention, and third, prevention. It has not been up to now a priority. So I think we need to change completely our focus and public policies. The second part is, well, more or less it will be exactly the same situation because these people didn't change anything. They didn't get any kind of Medicare, official Medicare before, so it is more or less the same situation after this approval. In this respect, I think these 7 million Mexicans that are completely out of this reform will continue going on daily basis to the health community centers, those thousands of health community centers that are spread all over the U.S. Possibly they will put more pressure now. Second is something for me difficult to understand, and I ask my American friends and colleagues why this decision of avoiding these people to get to hire private insurance is something difficult to understand for us, but it will be a possibility. And third, unfortunately, and as usual, once again, most of these people will continue knocking at the door of the emergency rooms of private and public hospitals in the U.S. So it's not a solution, but as a matter of fact, the situation will continue moving on as usual. And third, we are evaluating the possibility of promoting some pilot projects in the U.S. with the Secretaría de Salud of Mexico, Seguro Popular. Seguro Popular has been up to now concentrated on the Mexican side. We want to start promoting this pilot project in the U.S., so beyond the borders. So let's see if this can be a little bit kind of helping to take care of this tremendous problem we have with these 7 million Mexicans living permanently in the U.S. So my second comment, y es una de mis conclusiones de este debate, lo dijo el doctor Sepúlveda, las políticas públicas tienen que ser cada vez más transfronterizas. Tenemos un andamiaje de organismos multilaterales que fijan, que trabajan en políticas públicas de salud, en diplomacia de salud, pero también las evidencias nos indican que hay tremendos problemas que tienen que ser atendidos bilateralmente. Y ese es un poco el propósito del Instituto de los Mexicanos, del Instituto de los Mexicanos en el exterior. Por ejemplo, en el caso de la relación México-Estados Unidos.
Mexico-U.S. relationship. We have this problem that I described of the many health challenges with 12 million Mexican people, but we should not forget that there are also health problems for the U.S. population. Millions of U.S. people who go outside of the United States to address and to take care of health problems. There is a serious, even more expensive health service in the United States, and this is why there are many U.S. people coming to Mexico to take care of their health problems. So why are we able to diplomatically negotiate and help you, but you help me? I believe this is a big challenge for the years to come. Bilateral diplomacy has to be present in this. And these are serious problems for both countries. We have the baby boomers. There are many in Mexico. A conservative number talks about around 1.5 million U.S. retirees in Mexico. And it is a growing number, and they are facing many health problems. So why don't we start to talk about this bilateral topic, and why don't we diplomatically address this bilateral health problem that both countries face? We both have needs. Let's both look for solutions. And the third topic, on reflection, after listening to the very interesting comments of speakers and after listening to the questions, I coordinate not all the IME programs have to do with health. The most intangible topic is health. Health topics related to books that are tangible, but bacteria and viruses, this is even more complex. It is an intangible. How can we coordinate the most intangible? And for this, we need to have many more public policies, bilateral ones as well as multilateral ones. And it is also true that this internet, what you said about internet, it is essential, crucial, because many of the topics are addressed virtually. It was in 1985, during the Chernobyl's explosion, I left in Europe. And it was, I do not know if you were in Europe during Chernobyl's explosion, but we were in a coup d'état. We were not allowed to come out of our homes, and there was no internet, and there was a terrible situation of ignorance, lack of information on what was actually happening and the risks. A year ago, we faced more or less the same. Those who were in Mexico City, we were like in a siege situation, but a big difference. There was the internet. We were able to download lots of information and bulletins through internet. Internet has been a great evolution in terms of information, in terms of health. And this is a big, big difference nowadays, and we need to take full advantage of it.
Messages here. One is that health diplomacy is a legitimate new field in global health, as long as we understand global health as the international transfer of risks and opportunities. This health interdependence is what defines global health, and obviously health diplomacy is an important and integral component. I think the issue of portability of health insurance is a pending subject to discuss as part of the health diplomacy agenda. I think we need to define whether health in diplomacy is a means in itself or an end in itself. More money is being poured to global health. That is very, very welcome. We do not only need more money, we need better money. And this is not only in terms of more efficiency, better allocation, but also in terms of equity. And that's a take home from today. I do believe that bilateral programs such as PEPFAR has been very successful, but still, I hope we can give multilateralism another chance. Finally, I would propose that the development of health diplomacy as an academic field needs to have joint forces. 10 years ago, we did an attempt to have the Instituto Matias Romero and the INSP develop a joint program on health diplomacy. Just as we develop with the CIVE in health economics. So the idea of developing the academic field of health diplomacy with the Instituto Matias Romero, I think is worth another try. Please join me in thanking our distinguished panelists for this.